Blood and Veins and Origins of Mass. So this work was done in collaboration with Andrew Waldron from the Math Department and Rod Gover from New Zealand. So we have published two papers on this topic, and the references are listed here. I believe the first paper is has been published and the second is in the process. So here's a quick outline of my talk. In the introduction, I'll cover the global versus local scale gains, and then try to motivate tractors from a physics perspective. And in section two, I'll briefly discuss tractor calculus. Enough calculus to allow us to construct massive theories in curved backgrounds. So the first example of tractor calculus is going to be a scalar field in curved background. And section three, we'll move on to spin one system. So again, I'll use the tractor technology, and I'll try to write a unified equation that will include Maxwell, Broca, and even the conformally invariant spin one system. In section four, I'll get a bit more ambitious and try to write down a unified equation for spin two. That'll include massless graviton, a massive spin two system, a partially massless system, and even a new theory, which is a conformally invariant spin two system. And in conclusion, I'll just wrap up. It's just going to be a recap of this one and maybe talk about some future directions in which it may go. So first of all, let me start by discussing global scale invariance. So global scale invariance is rescaling of the underlying metric in any given theory. When we rescale the metric, it is not necessarily true that the action will be invariant unless we also rescale the coupling constant. For example, take Einstein-Hilbert action, and if I rescale the metric by some constant factor omega squared, this action is not invariant unless I rescale the coupling constant as well. And this rescaling of the coupling constant can be viewed as changing units. So this is the rigid Weyl invariance. This omega squared is not a function of x. It is some constant positive function, which is rescaling the metric. Well, Weyl's idea was that there's all the physical theories should have local scale symmetry. So there has to be an action which is locally scale invariant. And when we gauge fix that action, we get Einstein-Hilbert action back. So in other words, there's a gauge fixed version. This action is a gauge fixed version of some local symmetry. And in this case, that local symmetry is the Weyl invariance, where omega squared now becomes a function of x. And the action, the ancestor action of this Einstein-Hilbert action turns out to be this action here. So this action has a local Weyl symmetry. If I change the metric from g to omega squared g, and I also rescale the field sigma, so notice that there's an extra field here, sigma. To achieve local invariance, I had to add this extra field sigma here. So if I rescale the metric and I rescale the field like this, so this action is invariant under these transformations. Well, sigma has a name. It's usually called a Weyl compensator or a dilaton. And it was first discovered by Zimino. Now, if we take this action and we gauge fix it, in other words, we give sigma some constant value, which is kappa raised to some power, we actually recover our Einstein-Hilbert action back. So in fact, Einstein-Hilbert action comes from gauge fixing this action, which has local scale invariance. And it's easy to see why this has local scale invariance, because if we take the Einstein-Hilbert action, strip off the constant kappa squared, and change the metric to g over sigma squared, we get this action, which is locally scale invariant. And so if I plug these transformations into this, it stays it stays the way it is. It's invariant under these transformations. Okay, so, well, there's another way to see why this action is locally while invariant, or sorry, it has a locally scale invariant, or while invariant. And that is what we're going to do is we'll construct a d plus 2 dimensional vector im. And this vector basically will construct by using sigma. So this vector has information of scale in it. The top slot is just sigma, the middle is just a covariant derivative, and the last slot has the Ricci scalar and a Laplacian in it. Well, the nice thing about this vector is when the metric transform from G to omega squared and the scale transform from sigma to omega times sigma, this vector transforms very nicely. It's like basically Lorentz transformation where U is an SO3-1 here. U is actually an SOD2 value. SOD2 is the conformal group for on a d-dimensional manifold. So U is actually U lives in this conformal group here. And explicitly U is given by this, it has an omega here, and this cactus, it's again an omega inverse and one derivative on omega. Well, notice here that it has a lower triangular form. And now when this matrix hit this I, it transforms it as if you are transforming these things by hand under those transformations. Well, now we can use this I, and an object that transforms like this, we call it a tractor. It is a D plus 2 dimensional object which transforms like this with an SOD2 valued matrix. And such an object we call a tractor. Now we can rewrite the while invariant action that we saw earlier by using tractors. And here it is. It takes a really simple and more elegant form. So it's basically an I squared, where eta mn is an off-diagonal metric. This action has all the information that the earlier one had. So I is doubly special here. First of all, it's introducing the scale sigma into the theory. When G and sigma transform, it leaves this action invariant. But once you pick sigma constant, it controls the breaking of while invariance. So it introduces sigma and also allows you to control the breaking of while invariance. Well, now we are interested in studying the Gates transformations of UMN, that SOD2 valued matrix, then we are inevitably led to study tractors. So in the next section, I'll briefly discuss tractor calculus. It is a calculus on a conformal manifold, but I'll try to discuss it more from a physics perspective. So to build in any theory, we need a connection, and we need to know how it transforms under some symmetry. And we have fields. And again, we need to know how the fields transform under a given symmetry. So here's a tractor connection. It is built out of the field bind, and in the middle slot, you have a spin connection, and you have a row tensor sitting in the first column. And this object actually transforms very nicely when the underlying metric transforms. As the field bind transforms like this, which is same as saying the G goes to omega squared G, this transforms like a Yang-Mills field. So it makes our life easier when we are trying to construct while invariant theories. Well, the next is the tractor, what we call a tractor matter, or a tractor field. So a tractor field, it has a D plus 2 elements here. It has a TM in the middle slot, and you have a T plus and T minus on top and bottom slots. And again, it transforms with an SOD2 valued matrix UMN. But here there's an interesting factor, omega raised to the W here, and W is called the weight of this tractor. So remember the previous example, I was just transforming U times T, and there was no omega factor in the front. So that tells us that I is weight zero tractor. So I has a weight zero. Well, next I'll discuss some tractor operators. The first one is the projection operator. It is just 001. It's a constant. And its job is to strip off the top slot of a tractor. So if I have T plus, TM, and T minus, I hook X into T, it strips off the top slot. Just gives me a T plus. It's null and it's weight 1. So it transforms with omega raised to the 1.
Is that a tractor itself?
Right.
It is a tractor.
Right. Tractor of weight 1.
By the way, tractor suggests that somebody had some intuition associated with it. Is there any way you can, is there such an intuition? What is tractor? Why should
I
call this thing tractor to begin
right.
with?
So I think the original paper was published by Tracy on conformal calculus. And so it's called TRAC, and later on, I think in the 60s or 70s, it started to be known as twister theory.
Oh.
So it's a Tracy, TRAC from Tracy and Tur from twister.
Okay.
And they started calling it tractors.
Alright.
So it's a null operator, x squared is zero. Again, there's an eta MN off diagonal metric contracting these two indices. Well, the next operator is the most important one, and it's the Thomas D operator. In the top slot, it's just a number. When it's acting on some tractor of weight W, that's what you have. So the W is the weight of the tractor that Thomas D operator is acting on. So top slot is just a number. The middle slot is against the tractor covariant derivative. The DM, it's an E mu M, a field bind contracted with the tractor connection. And again, in the last component, it's a Laplacian, it's a tractor Laplacian again. It's two tractor covariant derivatives contracted. And P is just the row tensor. And again, this is a null operator. I'm actually going to write it on the board because we'll come back to it very often.
A plus 2W minus 2. So I'll just leave this here.
And the last one is something we've already seen. It's the scale tractor I. It's this Thomas D operator acting on scale sigma. Okay. At this point, let me just discuss sigma, because we've already seen sigma. So sigma here is just a choice of scale. When we're picking constant sigma, we are basically picking a preferred frame here. And IM simplifies. Remember, there was in the middle there was a derivative acting on sigma. So if sigma is constant, the middle slot is gone. And the last slot also simplifies. And it's minus 1 over d rho times sigma. Well, furthermore, if I take IM and I hit it with a tractor covariant derivative, it has 0 on the top slot, but look in the middle and the bottom slot. A familiar equation. And in fact, it tells you, if it is equal to zero, it tells you that my metric is Einstein. It satisfies Einstein's equation. It's like R mu nu minus some factor in the front, G mu nu times R, or G scalar. So these tractors somehow know about physics. Just by with the condition that D mu acting on IM equals zero, it tells me what kind of manifold I'm working on.
So why, I guess I haven't quite made the connection that a constant sigma is a preferred frame. What kind of frame are we talking about? A standard Lorentz frame, or?
I think probably like you can think of it as like a Weyl frame.
Okay, so it's not a conventional frame.
Right.
Then, so it's This is again just a technical phrase.
That's right.
Okay.
It's a preferred choice of a scale.
That's right.
Right, yeah. So
right.
That's the way I was thinking of it before, so I didn't know why he was using the word frame here.
Yeah, it's just
just
preferred choice.
Part of the language, all
right. That's right. Just call it a preferred frame. And I think at this point we have enough tractor technology to start building some theories here. And the first one, let's try to build a massive scalar in curved backgrounds. So I'm going to start out with the phi, a weight W scalar tractor function. And then the next question is, what should I impose as the equation of motion? So what I have was x, d, and I. And since it's a scalar field theory, I can't have any free indices. So my choices are very limited. It can be an x squared, but x squared is 0. Well, d squared is also 0. And we know somehow I has to come in. Because if I'm building a vial invariant theory, I has to come in because I introduces the scale in my theory. So the only choice that I'm left with is in fact I dot d phi equals 0. I can't use d squared, I can't use x squared. X dot d is just a number, it's the top slot of that Thomas D operator. So the only choice is I dot d acting on phi equals 0. And now I'm going to write this in components or in...
Well, let me ask you, what's wrong with I am phi equals 0? Is that would that be an allowed equation?
It will have an open index.
Okay, so you're not allowing an open index sort of equation of motion. I mean, I'm used to an equation.
I think for a scalar field, probably would like to soak up all the indices.
Yeah, okay. I understand what you're saying. I just don't know what the rules are of the game are here about these three indices, possibly three indices.
Yeah, actually, we'll see that. I think what you're saying, it will come.
Mm-hmm.
And it's at a certain value of W, I will be able to write such an equation. So here, again, holding sigma... First of all, this is manifestly Weyl invariant. I am DM. I am transformed with an SOD2 matrix. DM transforms like that. So this is manifestly Weyl invariant, a local scale invariance there. And now I'm breaking the scale invariance by holding sigma constant here. So by holding sigma constant, I get this equation of motion. And I go one step further, and I'm going to identify this part of the equation with m squared.
Is p a constant?
Yeah. So we'll hold p as a constant.
So the kind of background.
Rho factor.
P is the rho.
Yeah. So I don't remember the form of p anymore, but
it's r mu nu minus r times some g mu nu something.
Okay,
I think
so
it's coming up.
So it has free indices. That's what I was sort of. That's what. I'm
all right, and then it's traced over, so it's. P
oh, so
mu
it is,
mu.
Oh, it is traced.
Right.
Okay, so P
but
is P mu mu.
Yeah, so it's P, so we're tracing the two indices over.
It's not constant for an arbitrary space-time.
That's right. So here, I would like to consider the anti-de Sitter space, where P is constant and it's negative. But I think it is more generalizable, but for now I'm just going to say it's P is negative in anti-de Sitter space. And if I make the identification of this term with m squared, then what I get is a mass Weyl weight relationship. So my masses are calibrated to Weyl weights. Well, Weyl weights have no dimensions, while m squared has a dimension of 1 over l squared. So, well, p brings in, because it's two derivatives on a metric, so the dimensions are correct. So it calibrates my Weyl weights with m squared. And in fact, if I further impose that w can only be real, then I have this bound that m squared has to be larger or equal to p over rho over 2d d minus 1 squared. And this bound in anti-de Sitter space is something that's been seen before. It is the bottom layer of Friedman bound for stable propagation in anti-de Sitter space. So just
I'm trying to understand that statement. Is P, oh, P is negative?
Right.
So is P over 2D, D minus 1 squared, a negative number then?
That's right.
Okay, so right now you're allowing for negative masses.
That's right.
All right, okay. Checking.
Is that first equation equivalent to what you find in AES CFT?
The
first relation between the bulk mass and the scaling dimension.
I'm actually not
sure
about that.
This is a four-dimensional mass?
Actually, it's an arbitrary dimension that we can plug in.
If you do 3 plus 1 space-time,
mm-hmm.
W is an arbitrary scaling dimension.
Right.
And M is the mass of a four-dimensional particle?
Yes. I think.
Because the Brighton-Lehrer Friedman bound is bound in a five-dimensional AES, right?
No, it's an arbitrary dimension.
It's an arbitrary dimension, I think.
But it's one more than the actual number of dimensions you have in AES CFT.
The D and
if D is 3, then M is the mass of a particle in a five-dimensional space.
Mm.
So the scalar field that we're talking about, how many dimensions does it propagate in?
I think it can propagate in any arbitrary dimensions.
You have a D space dimensions,
right?
D plus two-dimensional space. Is it propagating D plus 1 or D plus 2?
D dimension, it's D plus 2.
This is all a D-dimensional theory.
D plus 2 is just
Laplacian is in D dimension?
That's right.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
But the Brighton-Lehrer Friedman bound is for D plus 1 dimensions, the mass. It's the mass of the particle with D plus 1 dimensions. So why, I don't understand you.
Yeah.
How these are connected.
Yeah, well, if that's true, then I don't either.
I thought
M squared is a mass in D dimensions,
yeah,
according to the Laplacian, so
right.
There's some contradiction here which I don't know enough about this to resolve.
The original Brighton-Lehrer Friedman paper was not especially about ABS-CFT. It was just looking at propagation of scalar fields in anti-de Sitter space,
mm-hmm,
and gave a bound for M squared in an arbitrary D-dimensional anti-de Sitter space. But I don't remember whether the bound is this with D, the dimension of the ABS, or if it's D plus 1.
I think at some point I checked it, the original paper, and Like Steve was saying, it was for an arbitrary D dimensions.
So
I haven't checked
ABS
CFT.
What's the dimension of your ABS space? That's, I guess, what I'm confused about. Is it D or
D
plus 1 or
D
plus
2? D dimensional.
The ABS
space
is D plus D.
Right.
D.
So D plus 2 dimensional is, it's just a vector that I'm building. It's in a D dimensional, on a D dimensional manifold. Because it transforms very nicely into conformal transformation, the Weyl transformation. Okay, so if I take W equals 1 minus D over 2, so now I'm going to pick some special value of W here. And so we look at this D operator that I wrote on the board. At D equals 1 minus, W equals 1 minus D over 2. The first term is 0. In fact, the second is also 0. And the last slot turns into a conformally invariant Yamabe operator. So in components, it looks like this, which, again, we have seen before. It is the improved scalar field. And now, the equation originally was I dot D equals zero. I can decouple I because I don't need I anymore. And my equation of motion can be dm phi equals zero. So at this special weight, I decouples. And it still has violent invariance.
So if the m squared that is implicit in that equation necessarily positive, or can it be negative? I guess it depends on d, of course, but so in a normal theory, one would take d equal 3 at this point?
Four.
So
4, okay.
So that's going to be...
And r would be positive or negative, or either side?
I think it will be positive. If you're contracting first and third index, it will be positive. So dm phi equals zero. So actually, this is something that we'll see again and again. At this special weight, 1 minus d over 2, even for spin 1, we'll get a conformally invariant theory. And I will decouple. Even for spin 2, at this special weight, I will again decouple, and we'll get a conformally invariant theory. And this trend holds even for higher spins.
So is there some motivation then for that choice, other than the fact that it does what you just said?
Sorry, W equals 1 minus?
Yeah, right. I mean, I understand what you just said,
right.
But is there some a priori motivation for that choice that's outside of what its consequences are?
I think this is, in the literature, they call this dimension some engineering dimension, and honestly, I don't understand why they call it. It has some special significance. It's called some engineering dimension of the field.
So there's no normalizations, anomalous dimension? Is that what you're saying? I mean, if something has the engineering dimension, then often that's associated with a non-normalization, anomalous dimension?
I think that may be true.
I'm not sure, though.
It's
been quantized, has it?
It's just classical at this point.
Okay,
so
okay. I see. So then there's no... Okay.
But
there's...
Well, so the engineering dimension would just be, if you just look at the transformation of a scalar field under... if you just look at the ordinary dimension of a scalar field,
mm-hmm.
as in the, in four dimensions... you have dimension 1.
Yeah, right.
And so W is
minus one.
So
okay, all
right. Right.
Okay.
So that it's
just that simple.
Dimensional
okay.
analysis dimension.
Right. Okay.
Okay.
So I think we'll carry out the same process for spin 1.
It's minus 1 because it's a length rather than
right.
length dimension rather than mass dimension.
Right.
It's going to be minus. So for spin 1, we actually need an SOD2 multiple at a mu. And so we can think of the v mu as an a mu, but I'm just going to leave it as v mu. And later on, at some point, I'll make this identification of v mu with a mu. So here's an SOD2 multiple. We have two extra fields floating around. One is V plus and V minus. For spin 1, all we need is just this here, V mu. So the field content is too high. And I need to impose a constraint. So impose a constraint that D dot V equals 0. And that eliminates V minus as an independent field. And it can actually be algebraically solved. So V minus becomes a function of V plus and V mu. It's not independent anymore.
So is this also fixing a gauge, or it's only just fixing V minus?
It's just fixing the V minus
okay.
part of it. And next, we have a gauge invariance. Just like we have a gauge invariance of A mu equals partial mu psi, I'm just going to replace that partial mu psi with the Thomas D operator and call it dm psi.
Now, when you say this is a gauge invariance, that usually is a statement about an action, right? I mean, this is a transformation, but whether it's a gauge invariance or not depends on whether it leaves your action invariant.
That's right. So, first of all, I'll impose a gauge. I'll say that this is my gauge invariant, and then I'll look for an action that obeys this gauge transformation.
Okay.
So I'll look for quantities, those tractor quantities that in fact satisfy my gauge transformation.
You mean that are invariant under your gauge transformation?
That's right.
Satisfy.
Okay. So if I write it in components again, this says the top slot is V plus, the middle slot is V mu. I'm not writing the last one because it has become a function of V plus and V mu once I've imposed the constraint D dot V equals zero. And so here, it's starting to become clear that at W equals minus 1, I will be able to get rid of V plus, which will leave me with Maxwell's theory.
You want W equal 1 minus D over 2.
Right, so that'll give me a conformally invariant. And in D equals 4, they'll coincide, minus 1 and 1 minus D over 2. So next is I basically search for tractor objects that are invariant under this transformation. And again, we have f mu nu, so I try fmn, build out of dm vn minus dn vm. So it's not really the curvature, it's just mimicking partial mu a nu minus the other way around. So, and I write this matrix down in components. And we can already see here we have fmn. This is the conventional Maxwell curvature here sitting here. These are Maxwell equations. And then these are the gauge invariant objects formed by V mu and V plus, V mu and V plus. When I want to write a Proker system, V plus is going to serve as a Stueckelberg field, because it has a shift symmetry. So these V tildes, it's just a combination here. It's a gauge invariant combination of V mu and V plus.
If I go back to the previous equation and set D equal to 1 minus, or W equal 1 minus D over 2, doesn't your fmn disappear there?
Right. So if I set 1 minus D over 2, then this term is gone, this is gone, this is gone. And again, at that point, I will be able to get rid of I and say fmn equals 0 is my equation, is my field equation.
But then it's different from the Maxwell equations or not? The fmn.
So what we'll be left with will be this part here where W equals 1 minus D over 2.
Mm-hmm.
And in D equals 4, it'll give me Maxwell.
Okay.
And for an arbitrary dimensions, it will be a conformally invariant theory.
Mm-hmm.
Is that written correctly then? Because
sorry, this
that
one?
Would setting that thing equal to zero would give you that the arbitrary covariant derivative of the contracted covariant derivative is zero.
So I'll then say fmn equals 0 at W equals 1 minus D over
right.
2.
Yes.
Which will say this equals 0.
Right, which isn't Maxwell's equations, which is much stronger than Maxwell's equations.
Right, in D equals 4, there'll be Maxwell.
But
in D
that,
equals
that,
4.
What are the indices on that first F on that line?
This one?
No, in the matrix.
In the matrix,
the
1 over, 1 over.
This
down,
one?
Okay,
yeah.
What is
yeah.
the, on the first F, what are the indices there?
R and M?
Oh, it is contracted. Right.
Oh, that's it. What's it on the top? Maybe I can't.
It's
yeah.
R and M.
I couldn't read it either.
R and M.
Right, it's
okay.
R
and M. Okay, got it.
Okay.
Never mind. I thought it was an M and at the time.
Yeah, it's an R.
Okay. Should change your font.
Okay, sorry about that. Yeah, actually,
okay.
That's confusing because R and M is.
Yeah, okay.
So, again, it's gauge
okay.
invariant under this transformation. And I'm going to contract I with it and call it my field equation. So this is the gauge invariant combination of V mu and V plus, as we discussed before, and this is my equation of motion. So I said, this impose this as an equation of motion again. I'm going to rewrite it in components. So again, we'll interpret the second part of this equation as m squared. And we'll have a mass-while-weight relationship again. Play the same game again, hold w to be real, and then m squared has to satisfy some bound, and this is again Brighton-Lohner-Friedman bound. And now at w equals minus 1, now I take my equation and I start analyzing it for different values of w. So the first one is w equals minus 1. Well, we can gauge away V plus, as I showed you before. So V plus, I can safely set it to 0 because the gauge transformations will not bring it back. Minus 1, it's inert. And then the theory reduces down to a Maxwell theory, at W equals minus 1.
Sorry, I'm confused about this as well. V plus is gauge invariant, right, at W equals minus 1. Delta V plus equals 0.
Right.
So you can set V plus equal to 0, but not by gauge transformation. That's, you're looking at some subclass of the set of solutions, right? And in general, this just says V plus is some extra gauge invariant field.
Right, but you're saying, with the choice of psi, I can't gauge away V plus?
No, I'm saying you can't. V plus is gauge invariant, right?
Right, because W equals minus 1, the delta V plus is
right.
0, right?
Okay, so why should V plus, so V plus is some gauge invariant field, why should it be 0? It's consistent
to say that you're
going to pull in some new equation in addition to your field equation.
Right, so I can consistently, maybe I could say, I can consistently set it to 0.
Right, okay. But you can equally consistently not set it to 0.
That's right, but I think to get the Maxwell, I would like to set it to 0.
So again, the question is, why this choice?
Yeah. So your field equations aren't Maxwell's equations. They're something like Maxwell coupled to some gauge invariant scale of field.
Yeah, if you just set V plus to 0 without choosing W, you probably get, don't you get Maxwell's theory then too?
Yeah, I can probably. Yeah.
So it's just that if W is not equal minus 1, the choice of V plus then becomes a gauge invariant choice.
That's right, because delta V plus changes then.
So the next sense, you've got to both have W equal minus 1 and choose V plus equal 0. And you know, why either one, I don't know. But then
I think so. Maybe we can think of it as a choice of V plus equals 0.
Okay.
And if we do that, we recover the Maxwell theory. And again, at W equals 1 minus D over 2, I can impose FMN equals 0, as we saw before. Most of the terms in the tractor curvature are 0, and only the middle term in the last column survives. And so now I can make an identification here. Again, I'm setting V plus to 0. And I'm identifying V mu with A mu, and A mu giving a rule for the transformation of A mu.
Okay, but I'm confused again. If D is not equal to 4, then the choice of W equal minus 1 and W equal to this are inconsistent, right?
That's right.
And then D plus becomes gauge invariant, becomes gauge dependent. So you can't just set it equal to zero, or you have to do that as choosing a gauge. Is that right?
Right. So here, since W equals 1 minus D over 2, the transformation of V plus is not zero.
Right.
So I can gauge away V plus.
Okay.
By using my C freedom.
Okay. Unless D is equal to 4.
Unless D is equal to 4. In which case, I'll have minus 1 and I'll be back to the Maxwell case.
Right.
And so if the last column, one term that survives in the Traktor curvature, it looks like this. And in fact, this is a conformally invariant theory that was first written down by Desiree Nabimeci. And it's invariant in any arbitrary dimension D, but it is gauge variant because I have picked the gauge. I've picked C to get rid of my V plus field here. So it's gauge variant, but conformally invariant in an arbitrary dimension D. And at D equals 4, the last term goes away, and then we recover the Maxwell again. And W equals minus 1 then coincides with D equals 4 here. So here's just a quick recap of spin 1. So we started out with this equation of motion I dot Fn equals 0, and W equals minus 1, we had Maxwell, 1 minus D over 2, we had Desiree-Nabimeci, and if I'm not at minus 1 or 1 minus D over 2, I in fact have massive Proker system, because my V plus stays and my V mu stays, and I have V tilde, which is gauge invariant. So this equation unifies Maxwell, conformally invariant, and massive Proker system. And now we'll try to do the same thing for spin 2. So conventionally we just have a metric and then we just expand it around the background metric and have some fluctuations H mu nu. So now we'll treat this as a Traktor fluctuation. We'll call it weight W VMN, treat that as weight W H mu nu. It's a symmetric Traktor tensor. And again, we have too high of a field content, so I have to impose some constraints. So once I impose these constraint, all the V minus N terms become dependent. So V minus plus, V minus small n, and V minus minus not independent anymore. It actually becomes functions, and again it can be solved. Well, the next thing is we build Christoffels. If we start with this one, the next thing we do is we build Christoffels there. I'll do the same thing. I'll build Traktor Christoffels here. Instead of delta mu vn or partial mu, I'm just going to use Thomas D operator here and the Traktor vnr. These are not the coefficients of a connection. If they're just Traktor Christoffels, I'm just mimicking what is done conventionally. And for equation of motion, I'm going to hook I into this and call it gmn equals 0. Well, then we have the gauge invariance. Usually it's V mu nu equals partial mu C nu. So again, I'm replacing partial with a Thomas D operator and C nu with C n. It's a weight W plus 1 Traktor here. And I need an extra condition here, I dot C equals 0. So if I write this gauge transformation in components, thus, these are the only independent fields. It's V plus plus, it's Vm plus, and Vmn. And again, we'll pick different values for W. And some of the fields will be eliminated either by putting them to zero or by gauging them away. So for W equals 0, let's just go back. So W equals 0, this term is gone. Vm plus Wcm, that's the second term, sorry, the first term in the second transformation is gone. And I can use my C plus freedom to gauge away V plus plus. I use C plus plus and gauge away V plus plus, and V plus M, I'm going to put it equal to 0. And then what I'm left with is V mu nu or V small mn, which is D times this one. These are just like linearized diffeomorphisms. So transformations give me the transformations of linearized gravity. And then even the equation of motion, once I write it down in components and I impose W equals 0, it actually gives us massless graviton at the end. So I'm not showing the equation in components because it's really ugly. But once you put W equals 0, it gives us massless graviton here. Again, at W equals minus 1, V plus plus is inert, and V plus n, the middle term, can be eliminated, the middle transformation. And then what we are left with is the partially massless gauge transformations. Again, it's a theory written down by Desert and Waldron. So we recover partially massless theory. Again, the equation of motion at W equals minus 1 gives the partial massless. So we get the transformations and the actual theory. Well, the next is W equals 1 minus T over 2. Again, at this point, the scale is going to decouple. The IM will decouple. And now I don't need an I hooked into the Christoffel's. Equals 0 as my field equation. I can get rid of I and just impose Christoffel's. And in fact, that gives us a new theory, which is spin 2 conformally invariant.
So which, if you have both W equal minus, well, if you have D equal 4, then again W is equal to minus 1, right?
Right. So
and we seem to have two different possible results, then the one on this page and the one on the previous page, which actually is
so correct. then it again, like the Maxwell case, D equals minus 4, they coincide, right? At D equals minus 4, W equals 1 minus D over 2, we got Maxwell back.
Right.
So here if I have D equals 4, W equals minus 1, I get a partially massless again.
Okay, but I might have said that maybe the result on the next page is the correct result rather than the partially massless result. So that's, aren't they different?
So at D equals 4, they're the same here. Partially massless, and this one reduces to partially massless.
Oh, it does? Okay.
Right.
Gamma Rmn equals 0 is equivalent to partially massless?
Like once you write it into components,
uh-huh.
And then you, everywhere where you see a W, you put 1 minus T over 2 and you put D equals 4. It's the same thing that happened for Maxwell.
I see. Okay.
So
that's what I was wondering. Okay.
Right.
Okay.
So you have a conformally invariant for W equals 1 minus D over 2, but once you put D equals 4, it's W equals minus 1, you get the Maxwell again.
Okay.
So it reduces to... So for this one, we have W equals 0, we have massless graviton, we have partially massless, we have conformally invariant spin 2, sorry, the typo, spin 2, and at D equals 4, like you were saying there, we recover partially massless again. And if it's not 0 minus 1 or 1 minus D over 2, we have massive spin 2 with the Pauli-Fierce terms there. So again, that one equation I hooked into gamma unifies all these theories here. And we also get a mass wild weight relationship, and again, predicting a Brighton-Lohner Friedman bound for this, the usual game we've been playing for spin 0 and spin 1. And we can actually generalize this method for higher spins. And all we have to do is, as we go up, we have more and more indices. So if you're talking about spin S, then we have S symmetric indices, weight W. and it's just going to be I hooked into D. It's like, you can think of it as like a curvature term with many, many indices here. I once hooks into D and then hooks into V. And then we have gauge invariance, and that I dot C condition again comes up. And we need an extra condition once we go beyond spin 4. Spin 4 and beyond, then this trace free condition on C becomes important as well. And then again, the constraints are also generalizable to accommodate any higher spins. And they predict a mass Weyl-Wade relationship for an arbitrary S and a Brighton-Lohner-Friedman bound. So originally, Brighton-Lohner-Friedman bound, when they were got, I think, with spin 2 or spin 1, it was a lengthier calculation than how they appear in this calculation. But here we're also predicting for an arbitrary spin, not for just spin 1 or 2 or spin 0. And I think that pretty much concludes it. So summary was, I guess to a certain extent, Weyl was right. So there is an underlying Weyl invariance which can serve as a unifying principle. And once we started constructing these theories, we actually got a new spin 2, which is conformally invariant theory out of this construction. The questions are how to incorporate interactions. And that's the next topic we'll like to think about, is interacting theories and massive gravity, which I don't know much about, but I'm sure people in this room know a lot more than I do. So I would like to talk about it, and maybe we can use tractors to write massive gravity. That's it. Thanks.
So you left out spin half.
Yeah. So we'll need. We haven't tried that, but I think it. That's another thing I wanted to do. We try a spin half. I think it's doable. Even though I haven't tried it. Even though we haven't tried it, I think you can do the same thing with instead of symmetric, you can do it with anti. Yeah, that's another direction we can take, but I'm not sure how to do it at this time.
Does SOD2 have a double cover? Normally you get spinners because you're looking at some covering group of the line scope.
I'm not sure if it has a double cover, SOD2. I think it might be doable for spinners as well.
This may just fall under your open question of interacting theories, but have you looked at all about, when you were talking about spin 2, you were just looking at linearized fluctuations around a flat metric. So, well, I guess I have two questions. One is, do you have any idea if there is some way of extending that to a full nonlinear theory for anything except the massless graviton?
Not at the moment. That's, yeah.
the second question, you may not have actually used this, but shouldn't you be looking at fluctuations around the Antide Sitter metric rather than around the Minkowski metric?
For linearized gravitons?
Yeah. Right. I mean, if you're looking, I mean, the Breitenlener-Friedman bound is a bound for Antide Sitter space, and your P is basically curvature, which is proportional to, which is non-zero and gives you your masses in Antide Sitter space.
That's right.
If you're looking at gravity, shouldn't it then be fluctuations around Antide Sitter space?
I think you're right. The hope is that the Breitenlener-Friedman bound predicted might be more general. And it might work for other spaces as well. Not so, as long as P is constant. But I think you're right.
P,
the row.
The indices or the trace?
The trace. But at this point, that's right. So the original Breitenlener-Friedman bound is for Antide Sitter space, mm-hmm. and it works very nicely here. But the hope is, even if P is not a constant, or it's P is not the Antide Sitter space curvature, we may still be able to do it. Mm-hmm. It might turn out to be more general than the Breitenlener-Friedman bound for Antide Sitter space.
But does it work for De Sitter space?
I haven't actually tested it yet. Let's see if it.
Or for Minkowski space, for that matter.
Well, just as the mass squared are positive.
Does it?
P is zero, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's always m squared.
The bound
is
always
p times something.
Is p times something, okay.
But is p equals zero consistent with flat space? P was some complicated thing, so I have no idea.
It's some r and g mu nu.
Yeah, the trace p is just some constant times the scalar curvature.
That's right.
Oh, okay.
So yeah. It's just r minus some factor, 1 over dd minus 2,
yeah.
g mu nu times r.
Okay, so then the first place to test would be for constant positive p for De Sitter space, where then you would be getting bounds that the mass squared has to be greater than some bound, which is greater itself greater than 0.
Oh, well, wait a
which
minute.
Which tell you there's
I
no
thought
gravity,
you
right?
I thought you told me P was positive for Antide Sitter space. I asked that.
Oh, this is a sign convention. Maybe I'm using a different sign
convention.
Yeah, there's a
sign convention.
So if you contract the first and third index, it turns out to be positive.
Depends
and
on the signature of your metric.
Exactly.
Okay, so are those bounds in Antide Sitter space?
Antide Sitter space.
Are those negative?
With
numbers?
P negative, right.
P is negative. Okay, so that's the opposite answer from what you gave me. All right.
Thanks.
So this would say, right, so for De Sitter space, you would be claiming that there's a bound that prohibits massless scalars, for instance, or gravity.
Well, you know that in De Sitter space, if you want to have mass of gravity, the linear is level, mass cannot be smaller than 2h squared.
Mm-hmm.
Because if it were, then the velocity zero is a ghost. And unless, of course, mass is exactly equal to zero, where you actually find additional gauge symmetries to kill all the extra mass.
Mm.
Nobody really understands that so well as to actually explain where it all comes from.
Mm.
But, you know, speaking of that, I mean, of this sort of big picture issue, didn't really follow the details, but I mean, maybe a way of rephrasing some of the stuff that you said in the language perhaps more common in effective field theory is to say that you basically promoted conformal symmetry into a pseudo-symmetry by introducing compensating fields, which then the theory wasn't really exactly the theory is not invariant. If you have a mass scale, then mm-hmm. that's obviously not invariant in a conformal symmetry, but you're basically, what you're doing is you're promoting, you're looking at is a motion in the field space, in the theory space, so various theories, that's what it is. And that's fine, that's interesting, but I wonder what sort of advantage could that give you over the more traditional approach? You know, can you give us some glimpses of the big picture that might lurk behind it? Why would I want to learn the tractor calculus apart from it being perhaps interesting or relevant?
Right, so the first is because it unifies it. It unifies many things. The second is, I think it, well, we have a hope that we may be able to write massive gravity in terms of tractors. Or I think the other thing that can be done is explaining the mass in 3D topological gravity, which I don't know much about, but so this is just a start. So I think once we'll start to look beyond these spin models, then I can probably say if it is interesting to learn or if it is just a mathematical tool.
Oops.